Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Charlotte Jackson about Art Santa Fe, and we'll be speaking with Bernard Rubenstein about the Cuba Caravan. I'm delighted now to welcome Elena Zachary and Suzanne Lederer. They are doing a reading of a play, Vita and Virginia, at Collected Works Bookstore this coming Sunday, the 18th of July, at 3 in the afternoon. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
It's nice to be here, Mary Charlotte.
It's always nice to be here, Mary Charlotte. Thanks for having us.
It's my great pleasure. This is a very, very interesting play, Vita Sackville-West and Virginia Woolf,
yes.
Who, as we get to know them through their letters, go through almost 20 years of life together during the course of this play. Tell us about the play. Is it all culled from letters?
It's all culled from letters and correspondences and research that was originally done by the English actress Eileen Atkins, who is probably most famous for creating the Upstairs Downstairs series for the BBC and ultimately the PBS that many of us grew up with. It was produced, Vita and Virginia was first produced at the Chichester Festival in England in 1992 and then eventually had a prestigious production in New York off-Broadway in 1994 starring Vanessa Redgrave and Eileen Atkins herself, and directed by Zoe Caldwell.
Wasn't there a revival then?
I think so.
I just can't recall what the year was, but it was recently.
Well, one of the things that's so interesting about it is that you can really reconstruct, certainly not the whole of, but a large part of the relationship through letters that they wrote back and forth. And I was thinking as I was reading it, you know, there was this period where these people wrote passionate letters to each other, and then the telephone took over, and now we have email. So we have basically the possibility of that kind of equivalent of 19th or earliest 20th century passionate correspondence that is not lost.
One would hope so. You know, I'm a traditionalist, though, Mary Charlotte, and I somehow feel saddened by the idea that brief messages that one kind of thinks of and shoots off via email or, Twittering each other, that kind of a thing, would cut short the type of creative, full, visionary, illusionary writing that these two women, for instance, were adept at in terms of being able to express your passion. Letters take longer to write. You have to sit down actually and create them by hand. It's like baking bread by hand or going to the store and buying a sliced loaf. It's a completely different experience. And I think that one of the things that I find so valuable in Vita and Virginia in terms of the letters is that it demonstrates how artistic the art of letter writing actually can be.
So these letters, when you read the play, as I just did, or if you are looking at a performance, it's hard to tell exactly how much time is going by in between when each one is written, although they seem to often really respond specifically to the previous letter.
Yeah.
You can tell pretty much what time frame you're in based upon what they're talking about, the names of the countries they're visiting, or the references to the beginning of bombing in London. You pretty much know that. And you can tell if it's a response to a query or the previous letter, or if it's a change of subject. It's really, really precise that way.
So the two of them were in what you would probably call a long-term relationship, but also married to their husbands.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And they called themselves sapphists.
Sapphists, yes. Virginia calls Vita Sackville-West a pronounced sapphist because that was her dedication from childhood, ostensibly. And you don't feel that Virginia was committed early on about that. But that was the terminology then. And by the way, Vita also had two sons. She had offspring with her husband, Harold, so...
And so this was something that I guess was not entirely uncommon, that people would be in a heterosexual marriage and would have a homosexual romance or series of romances in the case of Vita Sackville-West.
I think it was uncommon.
Was it?
I think it was. I think it was more uncommon than common, as homosexuality is still considered to be an alternative lifestyle now, as it was then, and heterosexuality is more the norm. I think that what makes this particular situation extraordinary is that there was a certain group of people that learned to accept more of an open lifestyle, and out of necessity, everyone was expected to marry a person of the opposite sex. So that being fulfilled for societal reasons, the fact that they had to basically go undercover and have their alternative lives going on was something that everyone had to reckon with at the time. But I don't think it was common. I think that that's because it was extraordinary is why we hear about it more in literature.
To what extent were their husbands aware of it, tolerant of it, and so on?
That's a great question. We should answer that independently based on the husbands to whom we are espoused.
Mm-hmm. Now, Elena, you're playing
Vita Sackville West, who was the, quote, pronounced sapphist, end quote. So her husband, Harold Nicholson, who was a diplomat, was absolutely a gay man and had affairs with boys all over the world throughout his life. So there was absolutely an understanding, but the marriage almost broke up over a long-term affair that Vita Sackville West had with a childhood friend, Violet Trefusis. So that there was a dramatic train ride, that they were supposed to sort things out, and one was going to give up in favor of the other. And in fact, they came to a tacit understanding that Violet pretty much disappeared, and she continued her marriage with Harold Nicholson throughout her days. And Harold, of course, welcomed Virginia. Everybody wanted peace in the kingdom. I think Violet, and I don't know whether Suzanne agrees, was probably the relationship of Vita's that was most in danger of shattering the relationship with the husband.
Which is odd, considering that he was no more heterosexual than she was.
But again, it speaks back to what Suzanne says. The conformity was to have an established marriage and produce offspring, and lineage was critical in this time. We refer to it later on when Vita Sackville West, who loves her childhood home, Knowle in Kent, loved it and wanted to inherit it and couldn't because of the laws of inheritance, had to pass through the male gender.
It's hard to say, according to the research that I've done and the reading that I've done, specifically as to why certain flare-ups happened, other than what we can imagine, knowing the nature of long-term relationship, what the long-term relationships can be, exactly what the problems were between Vita and Harold. I know, for instance, that from what I've read about Leonard Wolfe, In, for instance, a book that called Virginia Woolf and Her World by John Lehman, who was one of that group that personally knew Vita Sackville West and Virginia Woolf and her husband, Leonard Wolfe, that Leonard was unbelievably disappointed after his honeymoon, finding out that Virginia was not sexually responsive to him because he adored her, and she was a great beauty at her time, and she was charming and funny and wonderful, and he knew her for years through associating with her brothers at Cambridge, where they all originally met. All the guys originally met there, and then Virginia was introduced to them because one of the brothers had friends, but Leonard gave up his post, a political post in the Far East, to come back and propose to Virginia when he heard there was a chance that she might accept his proposal. She was very, very popular, and so he was shattered. Now, how he handled that through the rest of their marriage was, as far as I can only assume, was that he tolerated what she needed to do because she was brilliant, because they also got along unbelievably well as best friends. They were business partners in the Hogarth Press. And so his life was all about Virginia and himself and moving forward. And he accepted how she was for simply who she was.
It's really one of those rare examples in the history of literature and art where the husband plays a willing, supportive role to the great artists.
Yeah, it's interesting too, because John Lehman in his book also mentions the fact that so often Leonard Wolfe is referred to as the husband of a great woman, and it's forgotten that not only was he an accomplished political commentator himself, but he also was very well-to-do, and he also was a publisher. He ran the Hogarth Press that initially published Virginia Woolf's work.
At the same time, I mean, I guess there are so many examples of great artists whose wives have been completely forgotten and who did a great deal for them, but then here's this opposite example. So the two of them got together, and was it immediately a romance? Was it kind of like simmering chemistry in that terrain between romance and sexuality?
What do you think, Elena?
Well, Vita was always the aggressor. And so what I understand based on the book that Suzanne has quoted and Suzanne's anecdotes, there was a dinner that was set up by Vanessa, right?
Vanessa Virginia's, and her husband,
Virginia's
Clive
sister,
Bell.
Vanessa Bell, to introduce the Nicholsons to the Wolfs. And it was at that dinner that Vita took a fancy and wrote her a letter inviting her to become part of an organization. But it was a ruse to really get to know each other and to express interest. Because Vita knew her mind so keenly, there was no doubt that she wanted Virginia from the moment, from the get-go.
Now, at that time, Virginia Woolf was in her 40s, and Vita was...
She was 40.
Yeah, and Vita was about 10 years younger.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so this affair basically developed and went through the ups and downs that all relationships go through, except that they never did what we do in this contemporary era, which is shack up together.
Right. Right. They would vacation together, however, and they would visit each other. And their husbands knew about it. It was something that was simply tolerated and part of what they did.
They'd pick them up at the train station and take them over to the castle.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
And in a way, you can imagine that vacationing together but never living together and writing these passionate letters and going through the things they did really kept that sense of burning romance alive.
Yes.
For a long, long time.
I think so. I think that if they had lived together, I don't think the relationship would have survived as long as it did, the 19 years that it did, because I think they would have, as Virginia says, found each other out. Mm. And I think that Vita would have perhaps been jealous of Virginia's productiveness and her brilliance. And I think that Virginia ultimately would have thought Vita was a terrific person, but she would have gotten bored.
But she was jealous of Vita's other relationships with women.
Oh, absolutely.
But I think one of the most stunning things is Virginia writing Orlando. I wish you'd talk about that a little bit, Suzanne.
Sure.
Because this biography was, of course, about Vita Sackville-West. And the communications that they had about their literary output is just amazing.
We're talking about the play Vita and Virginia with Suzanne Lederer and Elena Zachary. And it's very interesting to witness this, too, because when you're seeing the play or reading along the play, Virginia Woolf is going through this moment where she's depressed, and then she writes down on a piece of paper, Orlando, a biography, is filled with joy and inspiration, writes this novel, and the novel is based on Vita Sackville-West.
Yes, yes. I think that Virginia... blossoms when she is filled with a new idea. And one of the things that she would find, well, she was manic depressive, so it was very easy for her to slip into a deep sense of ennui and a deep sense of loss, just from her own personal insecurity, from her hereditary, from her genes. When she would get a new idea, she would become euphoric. And this was one of the moments when it pulled her out of writer's block, and also one of her depressions, and she got the idea to write a book basically about androgyny, and it was inspired by her knowledge and her deep friendship with Vita.
How did Vita react to it once the book came out?
Well, she... it was stunning, and she was amused, but not at first. It took her a while to get to it. It was the dedication issue as well in that one in Orlando.
Yeah, I mean, she told her about it. She told her about it pretty straight. She didn't tell her about it while she was writing it, but Virginia told Vita once it was finished, and she said, "Would you mind? I've written this book, and it's about you. And would you mind?" And Vita, being the egotist that she is, was not only terribly flattered, but was overjoyed with the notion of it. And then, as Elena said, once she read it, it kind of had to sink in and for sort of to get the idea of it. And then suddenly she was wild about it and even says, "Virginia, you've coined a new form of narcissism. I am in love with Orlando."
So isn't that brilliant?
Very interesting. The fact of having a relationship like this with two people, one of whom, Vita Sackville West, is very prolific, but history has sort of shown her not to be nearly as good a writer as Virginia Woolf. There's this one moment, and it can't be from a letter, but there's a moment in the play where Virginia Woolf says, "I don't think I could stand more than a week away from Leonard, as there are so many things to say to him which I can't say to Vita, though she has a heart of gold and a mind which, if slow, works doggedly and has its moments of lucidity." I mean, talk about damning with faint praise or just outright insulting somebody who you're supposedly in love with.
I don't think Vita hears it at that point.
No, I know, but I mean, she says it and we hear it.
Well, I think Virginia's very truthful. She knows what she knows. She knows. I mean, when you're really an artist, you recognize your own kind, and you can love someone for who they are and what they can do that you cannot, that fulfills that area of you that's simply blank. But if they're in your field, you also recognize if they are your equal, your superior, or your inferior. And Virginia had no problem naming names.
There are qualities about Vita that Virginia adored. She, Vita's physicality, she does in great detail, even in the context of the play. The way Vita had a very large life. She was married to a diplomat. She had two children. She had houses to maintain. And Virginia talks, you know, with a little bit of awe that all of the things that Vita can accomplish in her life. And Virginia seems to say that her life of leisure, you know, to put a stamp on an envelope and take them to the post, you know, was something. And so there was a quality of that kind of admiration about how Vita, who, not part of the Bloomsbury group, still was a socialite and was very sophisticated in her worldly travel and her way of organizing and having to be the wife of a diplomat.
And occasionally she'll write about that in a letter and she'll say something like, "If one more person kisses my hand, I'm going to smack him."
Right. Yes. Yes. Yeah. She had... I think that Vita also had a certain level of tolerance for the life that she had to live with Harold Nicholson. They were both of the aristocracy, and she had to be a socialite. She had to hobnob with those who had nothing to say of interest to her. She much rather would have hung out with the artists, but because of her political situation and her marital choice, she had to be with people that were deadly boring and be subjected to endless dinners. But the upside was she met incredible people and traveled all over the world. I think that one of the big things that attracted Vita and Virginia to each other was that they complemented each other, and what one didn't have, the other one had, and then they could share that, put it together, and come up with almost a whole new woman.
And I think there's almost a maternal instinct that, obviously, Virginia, who had these major crises in her life, the death of her mother, death of her father, death of her stepmother, that you get the sense of the letters that there is a little bit of maternal feelings that Vita has for Virginia. You know, Virginia writes about, "I left my hair clips behind, I left my this, my that, my heating pad," and Vita says, "Not to worry, but make sure that you get the right coat, you know." She asks about the black coat, and Vita says it should be black velvet coat. Yes. So she's very much a caregiver towards Virginia.
She sends her the butter
in
World War II, which was
phenomenal.
Phenomenal. Nobody had any. Everything was on ration.
And a fire starter. An American fire starter.
She took care of her.
A lighter, presumably.
Right, of course, Vida could do it because she was a mother anyway. She had that. She had two children, so she knew how.
And she also had the exposure, having lived all over the world.
Yeah.
You know, one of the wonderful anecdotes in the play that, and it annoys Virginia because Vida puts off returning because she's going to have an opportunity to spend a day with someone who's about to become, wasn't it a priest in some sect or other?
A Pharisee.
That's it. And this was the last opportunity for him to
live it wild.
So is Wild Oats. Those are my words, not Vida's.
But that was what it was, yes.
And meanwhile, she says, he's great, but I really prefer his sister.
Yes. Well, there she was. She made no bones about it. There's a point that she dedicates one of her volumes of poetry to one of her former loves, and it does not pass this, you know, the notice of Virginia at all. It comes up in conversation quite a bit.
Oh, yeah.
One of the things that is also fascinating and kind of poignant and even painful while watching the play, well, for me reading the play, I haven't seen it yet, is there are these moments where they're talking about how repressive England is toward homosexuality or so-called sapphists or lesbians, which is a word that was only just being coined. And they say, if only we could be in Berlin. And this is just a very short time before Hitler rises to power and breaks all of that apart. And you're reading it going, oh, no.
Well, it reflects back to Cabaret.
Yeah, you know. Exactly.
1939, and anything went.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. Also note that the word sapphist comes from the Greek woman philosopher Sappho, and she preferred women. And that's where the word actually came from.
Right.
Right, so...
We're talking to Elena Zachary and Suzanne Lederer. One thing that I found so interesting is here are these two literary figures of the 20th century, and at a certain point, Virginia Woolf says, my great passion in life is cooking, and
yes.
Vida Sackville-West says, my great passion in life is gardening.
Yes, that's true. It really is. I think that Virginia discovered cooking, and she says at one point in the play, Why write all these novels that make me so crazy when I could be cooking? Today I bought an oil stove and I created veal cutlets and a cake. This what great satisfaction this is. She longed, she says, that on occasion she longed for the simpler life. She'd rather have never read a book ever because it all makes her so frantic, and yet it's her main activity. And Vida likewise was... Not if she wasn't a brilliant writer as Virginia, she was a truly, truly a genius at horticulture, wasn't she, Elena?
Yes, and she had, up until the last years of her life, wrote, might have been the London Observer, I may be wrong about the publication, but wrote gardening columns. And what's interesting, and it ties it to the here and now, there was a book published not that long ago by her grandson, Charles. Now, Sissinghurst, which was the castle that they purchased, that she and Harold Nicholson purchased, is now owned by the National Trust. And apparently the gardens had gone to rack and ruin. But the family is still allowed to occupy, and so the great-grandson wrote a book about the restoration of those gardens and what it's like living in Sissinghurst. And those gardens are open, as is the castle today, to tours. So it's still ongoing, and she still has the reputation of having been a phenomenal horticulturalist and writer of same.
This play, Vida and Virginia, is the second in a series of two-person readings, not even staged readings, just straight-ahead readings of plays, of two-person plays. The first one was Love Letters that you did on Valentine's Day last year with our great friend whom we still miss very much, Bill Vertebra, who died suddenly not too long afterwards. And so this is the second, yet a different kind of love story, Vida and Virginia. What's your plan for this series?
We're taking it as it comes. It seems to be about 6 months apart, although there is no timing implied. We had to move forward with the series idea, and Suzanne was always in on it and gave us direction and coached us on Love Letters. It was natural that this was a suggestion that came from Suzanne, so that's why we're doing it. Of course, it is always current, especially for our society in Santa Fe, but we haven't thought to the next piece. There's some lovely options, but we wanted to... Dorothy Massey made a very welcome place for us to do this. These two-person readings on somewhat of an ongoing basis, and we always have to find the right date as well as the perfect project.
Is there any significance to this Sunday's date in terms of Vita and Virginia's life?
It was the date that was available Dorothy to gift us with over at Collected Works, and so now it's this Sunday, July the 18th, is now formally dedicated as Vita and Virginia Day.
But they've
there will be a proclamation.
Absolutely, and there are they've increased the works by both Vita Sackville West and Virginia Woolf that are available to people that come to see the reading, so that we certainly are backing up the reading by all of that great literature that is now available to us.
There must be a ton of biographical and critical and all that kind of material, as well as the actual works of literature by these authors.
Absolutely, there is. And not only did Virginia Woolf write novels, she wrote criticism. She wrote newspaper articles. She wrote book reviews. She was famous for her book reviews, and actually she was handed in the London papers the jobs of reviewing the latest books on Chaucer and Shakespeare, and in addition to the modern writers of the time. And she took great care in doing it. She was constantly writing. I mean, she honestly looked at everything as if it were a job and part of her work.
Vita accuses her of using the relationship as copy, that every person is copy.
That's right.
And to a certain degree, I think that was true. It didn't deny her feelings, because she was a tremendously feeling individual, but she utilized absolutely everything that she came across in her life and used it somewhere in her work. She was truly a dedicated artist, constantly writing.
There are some little moments. I mean, the play isn't primarily about this, but there are little moments where you get things about craft from Virginia Woolf. There's one where Vita is talking about, you know, coming up with the right word, and Virginia says, "No, you're wrong. Style is a very simple matter. It is all rhythm. Mm-hmm. Once you get that, you can't use the wrong words."
Yes. Vita wonders, is there a difference between writing poetry and writing prose?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, Virginia Woolf was a modernist. She was part of a very early group of writers that revolutionized novel writing at that particular time. Following in the footsteps of James Joyce's Ulysses, she wrote very much in terms of train of thought. So the way that she expressed herself was not traditional. And if you read any of Virginia Woolf's novels, if you read To the Lighthouse, or if you read Mrs. Dalloway, you understand that sense of this very undercurrent of not only storytelling, but the emotions behind it. And it's a very different way of writing than a beginning, middle, and an end. And she was she became sensational because of it.
And at the same time, this stream of consciousness style is entirely crafted. Another thing that I learned from the play was when she wrote Orlando, once she had a draft, she says, "Now I have to go back and rewrite every single word of it."
Yes, yeah. Well, that's, yeah, she understood the craft of it. She really had her technique down. She learned originally how to write through her fascination with books, because she was not formally educated. Her brothers went to Cambridge. She did not go. Because she was a woman, they stayed at home and they were expected to learn how to run a household. And she spent most of the time with her father's books.
There was a wonderful anecdote in Virginia Woolf and her world, John Layman, about the dad was very literate. Didn't he write work for like a National Biography, something like that?
He did.
So that their library was comprehensive. And what was amusing was he fed things for Virginia to read. And once the dad was so impressed with her erudition and her choices, he let her roam the library free. So she wasn't funneled the typical literature of the times that women would have been exposed to. Mm-hmm. A very important point, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, the whole family was tremendously literate. They were very, and so Virginia Woolf's family was highly, highly intelligent. Highly intelligent.
And so luckily we have her legacy, and luckily she was given enough freedom and enough work that we have a whole body of work from Virginia Woolf, which was only cut short by her suicide.
In 1941, that's right, yeah. Well, that was because of what they refer to in the play as her her madness, but they really didn't know what to call it. As far as I can determine, I would coin it along the lines of a manic depression.
Vida has a note in one of the very early passages that she's concerned about bringing out madness in Virginia by
approaching her. Right, right.
So everybody's aware that Virginia has these episodes.
Well, and I mean, we've discussed on this program before that in, you know, a lot of literature and theater, you have tragedies that would have been averted by therapy and psychopharmacology today. And
absolutely.
In these characters, you have the same thing.
Oh, I think so. I mean, you know, where would great art be in a way without a tremendous amount of dysfunctionality? It's an awful thing to say, but I mean, you know, come on, think about it. If everything was happy ever after, we wouldn't, you know, everything,
yeah.
We'd see everything in a golden glow and everybody would, you know, live happily ever after, which would be awfully nice as opposed to something that's longed for.
Well, it's another long and interesting conversation, which we will probably have in the future.
Oh, goody.
Suzanne Lederer and Elena Zachary in Vida and Virginia, a reading this coming Sunday, the 18th of July at 3 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's always a pleasure, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. I appreciate it.
We're going to take a break and we'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Charlotte Jackson. She is the owner and director of the Charlotte Jackson Gallery, and she is the director of Art Santa Fe, which is happening this coming weekend. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
So you have a beautiful gallery, actually two galleries, but you are moving now permanently to the Rail Yard and are going to close the Marcy Street Gallery here in Santa Fe. And let's talk for a moment about you and the gallery. What kind of work do you have there?
Well, this is a big move for us. I've been on Marcy Street for 21 years, and that's a big deal. So we're finally leaving Marcy Street and actually moving into the Rail Yard, which is very exciting for us.
Exciting for the Rail Yard, too.
It is. I think the Rail Yard is very exciting. I think there's all kinds of wonderful things happening there, and I think that there's an exciting future for the Rail Yard itself in terms of what the Rail Yard Corporation is doing and the city's doing. So I'm very excited to be a part of it.
And so you are really focused on contemporary and I guess what you would say mid to late 20th century art.
Yes. We have always had a relatively severe program dealing with monochrome paintings. And in the last few years, we have sort of explored the roots of monochrome painting and really delved into modernism. But we, you know, I have a real cross-section in terms of older artists. A lot of my artists are older, not because I choose it that way, just that's the work I'm drawn to. The work that's up currently in the new gallery at the Rail Yard is actually a guest-curated show by Bobby Fauché. And when we knew we were going to open a week before Art Santa Fe, I thought, uh-oh. And so I talked with Bobby, and she was thrilled to curate the show. And so she has gone out, and she said, you know, what do you want me to do? Do you want it to be within your program? And I said, no, I want it to be your vision. And I just think she's done a fabulous job. She's brought in artists from all over New York, Holland. There's a great Dutch artist in there. A lot of photography, some video.
Some self-portraiture.
It's all about self and family. And so it's very exciting and a very wonderful vision. She has a great eye. She's a great curator.
Let's talk about Art Santa Fe. That is something that's been going on. This is the 10th year.
It is the 10th year. I can't believe that if I'd known in 1999 when I took this over that I'd be doing this 10 years later, I would never have believed it. But bit by bit, you know, we just kept thinking, well, it's great for the community. It brings people in here. It brings dealers from all over the world. And we've had great response. People love Art Santa Fe.
It's an art fair.
It's an international contemporary art fair. And we literally have people that have been with us for 10 years. A gallerist from Munich, Germany, Renata Bender, she's been with us for 10 years. Adel Gallery from Japan has been with us for 5 or 6 years. I mean, we have people that have been with us. They come over and over and over again. And that's really exciting for us to know that we are doing something right if they come back every year and want to be a part of this.
It's a commercial art fair in the sense that people come from all over the place and they are selling stuff that we don't normally get to see here in town.
That's right. I mean, we have it is a wide variety of art, and it is people from all over the United States. There's also local galleries as well, which is exciting. Those are, you know, Linda Durham's been with us for many years, Billy Siegel. I mean, a lot of our good galleries are here with us, and they support this project as well. But if you sort of look at what happens on the opening night and during the weekend, we get people that fly in on their private planes for this event. I mean, this is not like something that just happens, you know, in Santa Fe for us, which is a great bonus. But it also brings collectors in from all over the United States and all over the world, for that matter, because we've had Europeans come in for it as well.
It's quite amazing. Last weekend, SOFA, and Folk Art Market, coming weekend, it's Art Santa Fe.
It's like an action-packed summer, and how exciting for us. I mean, Santa Fe is so hot right now again, which is wonderful for our community and for the businesses in our community.
And you're not just talking about the fact that it's 95 degrees outside in
no,
the afternoon.
No, I'm not. I'm talking about the fact that the New York Times has done like numerous articles on us recently. As a matter of fact, New York Times is one of our sponsors this year. And they will be at the Vernissage, the opening night. So we have a lot of people that are interested in what we do from far away. And that's, of course, a part of what keeps us going every year is the fact that there are people who are interested in what Art Santa Fe is about and where we're going with it.
Now, the opening night gala, which is Thursday, the 15th of July, from 5 to 8, is a benefit for the Santa Fe Art Institute.
It is. Diane Karp is great. She's always been a super supporter of Art Santa Fe. She always has a booth with us, a special project booth where she can showcase her artists. And we've just always had a long-term relationship with them, and so this year they are a beneficiary of the opening night. And I think it's going to be a good night. We sold a lot of tickets, so.
Who's the keynote speaker?
The keynote speaker is Roberta Smith, who is the main reporter for the New York Times, art critic for the New York Times. And I think we have 20 tickets left for sale. I mean, literally, it'll be sold out by the time we open. And that lecture is on Saturday, the 17th of July, and it's at the New Mexico History Museum Auditorium. It's a wonderful environment. We love that auditorium, and so we use it every year.
The History Museum is wonderful. It's so much is happening there. I can't even get it all on the air.
It's very exciting, and they have been so generous to us to let us use their auditorium and open it up. We used it last year for Michael Kimmelman, and this year, of course, for Roberta Smith. So we're very excited to have her. She's very sought after. She's a great speaker, and I think it's going to be an exciting evening. That starts at 6:30 on Saturday evening, and tickets for that are available at the Lenzick box office as well as for the fair,
which is 505-988-1234. So the big gala starting at 5 on Thursday night, and then the fair hours Friday from 11 to 7, Saturday and Sunday from 11 to 6, and this special event at the New Mexico History Museum on Saturday. So much to do. Santa Fe, Charlotte Jackson of the Charlotte Jackson Gallery, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I'm delighted now to welcome to the program Bernard Rubenstein. He is an orchestra conductor. He is a member of the Sister City of Santa Fe Executive Committee and the president of the Cuba Sister City Group. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's a treat to be with you this morning.
So you are part of an event that is happening tomorrow, Thursday the 15th of July, here in Santa Fe. The Cuba Caravan is visiting this city for the first time. What is the Cuba Caravan?
The Cuba Caravan is a program by the Interreligious Fellowship Community Organization in New York. For the last 21 years, they have been sending buses, school buses generally, from all over the United States and Canada. They cross over the border into Mexico, and they're shipped by freight to Cuba, and they bring medical supplies, construction materials, and needed equipment, which is not possible to get to Cuba because of the 50-year-old embargo and trade boycott that our country has unfortunately persisted in continuing.
Now, was it last year that there was some trouble with the materials actually getting to Cuba?
Almost every year at the border, the United States Border Patrol acts in a harassing fashion. They examine every single box. They confiscate computers. And they make a very, very difficult time for this equipment to cross through the border.
Which is odd. odd because they're leaving the country.
That's true.
Can think Border Patrol is about what's coming in, not what's going out.
That's true. It's an irrational policy by the Border Control. But the idea of the Cuba caravan is to cross the border and send this equipment and the members of the caravan, whom we call caravanistas, without asking permission from the United States government. In other words, they're trying to keep the pressure on to end the blockade and normalize relations with Cuba. So they refuse to ask for permission. They feel as American citizens we shouldn't have to ask where we travel. So it's just a protest and also a goodwill journey with all of these buses. And we're going to have now two buses joining in Santa Fe, the very first time in Santa Fe. We'll have a welcome ceremony tomorrow at 4 o'clock on the plaza, and the Cuban band Sabor, the Santa Fe Cuban band, will play, and we'll welcome the caravan. And then in the evening in Westminster Presbyterian Church, it's on Manhattan Avenue, between St. Francis and Manhattan Avenue, we'll have a little program talking about the caravan. The caravan members will speak. And we'll have a reception at 6 o'clock and then a program at 7. So any listeners who are interested in Cuba issues, in the caravan, in United States foreign policy, are more than welcome to come to our welcome ceremony on the plaza at 4 and in the evening at Westminster Presbyterian Church.
And, of course, music by Sabor, which is a wonderful band that plays Cuban music that's based right here in Santa Fe.
Oh, yes. Victor is very happy to play a little Cuban music for this welcome ceremony. It'll be a lot of fun.
So this is Pastors for Peace who are behind all of this. How is Cuba policy changing? One thing I've noticed is that there's a lot of Cuban musicians playing all over the United States. We had Tradición here, Pupi Los Quezon Sonner in New York.
Buena Vista Social Club has come, although they didn't get their visas in time to play in Brooklyn a couple of weeks ago. But it seems in the last half year, more musicians have been given permission to come to this country.
It's unbelievable.
It is, and one would hope that this is the start of a relaxation of policy. Those of your listeners who might follow Cuba policy might know that the House Agricultural Committee passed a bill, through the committee bill at least, into Congress to open up agricultural sales and open up travel to Cuba. And whether this will be passed by Congress remains to be seen. But there does seem to be some momentum. Just in the last couple of days, Cuba has released some political prisoners, whether that will have any effect at all. And Fidel even appeared on television last night, which was remarkable. But the idea is, and I'm very, very much in favor of cultural exchange and letting people go to Cuba. I've enjoyed my trips. I've been to Cuba now 8 times, conducting Cuban orchestras. And I have Cuban students. I get a dozen emails every day from Cuban friends. And the fact that United States citizens are not allowed to Cuba is just a travesty from my point of view.
And one of the things that I think has to be made abundantly clear is that Cuba will give anybody a tourist visa for $15 in the airport in Mexico. It's the United States that doesn't want them to travel. And it's not even a State Department thing. It's a Treasury Department thing called trading with the enemy. They don't want you to spend any money in Cuba. But it's never. People always say, oh, well, how do you get a visa to go to Cuba?
It's very easy.
You buy $15
at the airport.
In the airport.
It's very easy. The Cubans are so hospitable and so welcoming. And anyone who goes to Cuba, and the many Santa Feans who have been to Cuba, members of our group have traveled to Cuba under various associations, have always had a marvelous time. The Cuban hospitality is wonderful. The people are warm and welcoming. You don't have to worry about crime. You don't have to worry about acts of violence. The culture is extraordinary. The music, as you well know, and the dancing is just fabulous.
And if you're going as a journalist, as I have done, you can interview virtually any musician in the whole country. There's no sort of firewall around them.
Absolutely not. You can go and talk to anyone on the street. You're not. No one is restricted from speaking to you. And so the idea of the caravan is just to publicize this blockade. This has been going on for over 50 years. To end the embargo, and everyone needs to work very hard to open up agricultural sales, open up travel to Cuba, so that we, as Americans, can express our freedom to travel, which we should enjoy with all countries. We can travel to China, we can travel to Vietnam, why not Cuba?
We're talking to Bernard Rubenstein. So tell us about the Sister City program.
Santa Fe has a sister city. Many people in Santa Fe are not aware that Santa Fe has its own Cuban sister city. It's the third largest city in Cuba, called Holguín, H-O-L-G-U-I-N. Has a strong culture. They have their own opera company. They have wonderful theater groups, children's puppet groups. They have a wonderful orchestra. I've conducted their opera and their chamber orchestra on many occasions. The city of Holguín is a wonderful, wonderfully cultural city. And the purpose of the Santa Fe Cuba Sister City Association is to continue contacts and cultural contacts with our Cuban sister city. And it would be my hope and the hope of our Cuba Sister City group that we can bring cultural groups from our sister city to Santa Fe at some time. We've had interest from them. There's a children's puppet theater that I could see appearing on the plaza and at the Children's Museum. And, you know, it would just be wonderful to have a more open exchange with this group.
Now, Holguín is a place I've never been, but whereas Havana and Matanzas and Santiago are really Afro-Cuban cities, this is more of a kind of European, Euro-Cuban city.
Yes. Holguín has less of the Afro-Cuban culture in contrast to Santiago, which is very African in culture. And it's more European, perhaps, in many ways. If you visit Holguín in the winter, you'll see thousands of tourists from Canada, Spain, France, Germany, all of the European countries visit Holguín, which is a very welcoming for tourists, with the exception of United citizens who are not allowed to go there.
So you have done a lot of conducting there.
Yes, I've worked with the opera company there called Teatro Lirico, wonderful singers, and I would just love at some point for some of their talented singers to be apprentices with the Santa Fe Opera. You know, I've done Mozart operas, I've done La Boheme, I did a performance of La Boheme with them, and they do zarzuelas, and it's just a wonderful, wonderful company. And they have theater groups. They have one of the most outstanding modern dance groups that I've ever seen, called Codanza. A very strong cultural life in our Cuban sister city.
And their artistic and musical training is very good.
Excellent. Every city has conservatories. The most talented children get free musical education, and they can get free musical education throughout their entire careers. They're sent to the conservatory in Havana for their advanced education. I have many students. As a matter of fact, I have several conducting students, women conductors. One of my women conducting students is now the head of the orchestra in Santiago. She just graduated from the conservatory with top honors last year. So very talented musicians of all sorts. Many of them go to Europe for advanced scholarships in France and Germany. We're aware certainly of the popular musical culture in Cuba, but not aware of the strength of the classical musical culture in Cuba.
So the Cuba Caravan, once again, will be visiting Santa Fe tomorrow, Thursday, the 15th of July. And at 4 o'clock, there will be a welcome ceremony at the plaza in Santa Fe with music by Sabor. To say those R's.
Yes.
All of them. And then a reception at the Westminster Presbyterian Church at 6 o'clock. And that's close to downtown, at 841 West Manhattan.
It's on Manhattan, right at the intersection of Manhattan and St. Francis.
So and you can pretty much walk there from the plaza.
Yes, not too much difficulty. And then the caravanistas will give a little program at 7, talk about the caravan. And if any of your listeners have construction materials, books, technical books, scientific books that they would like to contribute, we're accepting all sorts of things for contributions on Thursday evening at Westminster Church. And if they would like more information, they can go to the IFCO site. That's www.ifcnews.org. And if they'd like to contact me about the Santa Fe Sister City program, they can go Santa Fe Holguín, H-O-L-G-U-I-N, Sister Cities at yahoo.com.
Excellent.
Santa Fe Sister Cities, Holguín Sister Cities at Yahoo, and they can have contact with me.
Bernard Rubenstein, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz features a visit from jazz photographer Paul Slaughter to discuss his new book. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. Tune in tomorrow. Tomorrow is our one-day fun drive. One day only, ladies and gentlemen. We need your support. We hope you will tune in. We've got a fun show for you tomorrow on the cafe, and I will be there much of the day as well. So keep your dial tuned. KSFR, Santa Fe's only public radio station, broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company. Hasta la vista. Ciao.